Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. This week, we present new research on treatment for muscle-invasive bladder cancer, left atrial appendage closure versus medical therapy for atrial fibrillation, gene editing approaches for sickle cell disease and beta thalassemia, and the safety of discontinuing beta blockers after myocardial infarction. We also review GLP-1 receptor agonists and discuss a clinical problem-solving case of a man with progressive confusion. Perspectives explore corporatization, biologic as opposed to chronologic aging, and a legal case that could affect mental health policy. A new clinical decisions addresses the possible approach to a woman with alcohol-related liver disease. This feature about acute liver failure on the background of alcohol-associated cirrhosis offers a case vignette accompanied by two essays. You must decide whether to refer this patient for liver transplantation or to continue the intensive care management alone. What would you choose? Visit NEJM.org to read more and vote. Perioperative enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab in bladder cancer by Christoph Volsteck from the AZ Maria Middelaris, Ghent, Belgium, and co-authors. Patients with muscle-invasive bladder cancer who are ineligible for cisplatin-based chemotherapy generally proceed directly to radical cystectomy with pelvic lymph node dissection. This Phase 3 trial evaluated whether perioperative therapy might improve outcomes in this population. 344 participants with muscle-invasive bladder cancer who were ineligible for or declined cisplatin-based chemotherapy were randomly assigned to perioperative, neoadjuvant and adjuvant, enfortumab vedotin, an antibody-drug conjugate directed at Nectin-4, plus the PD-1 inhibitor, pembrolizumab, and surgery, or surgery alone, the control group. At 2 years, perioperative enfortumab vedotin plus pembrolizumab and surgery led to significantly better event-free and overall survival outcomes, and a greater percentage of participants with pathological complete response than surgery alone. Adverse events, including death, occurred more often in the enfortumab vedotin pembrolizumab group than in the control group. Parminder Singh from the Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine, Phoenix, Arizona, and Seth Lerner from the Baylor College of Medicine, Houston, write in an editorial that the results of the trial by Volsteck and co-authors represent a potential shift in the management of muscle-invasive bladder cancer. However, the trial does not yet redefine the standard of care for bladder preservation. Given unprecedented percentages of participants with a pathological complete response among persons who were ineligible to receive cisplatin or who declined cisplatin, enfortumab vedotin plus pembrolizumab redefines what is achievable before definitive therapy and challenges traditional exclusion criteria for bladder preservation, as several key areas warrant further investigation. Future trials will be pivotal in determining whether enfortumab vedotin plus pembrolizumab can safely and effectively serve as a neoadjuvant platform for bladder preservation. Left atrial appendage closure or medical therapy in atrial fibrillation by Ulf Landmesser from the Charité University Medicine, Berlin, Germany, and co-authors. Catheter-based closure of the left atrial appendage is an alternative to oral anticoagulation for stroke prevention in patients with atrial fibrillation. This study evaluated the effectiveness of this strategy as compared with physician-directed best medical care in patients at high risk for stroke and bleeding. 912 adult patients with atrial fibrillation and a high risk of stroke and bleeding were randomly assigned to undergo left atrial appendage closure or to receive physician-directed best medical care, including direct oral anticoagulants, if eligible. Among these patients, left atrial appendage closure was not non-inferior to physician-directed best medical care with regard to a composite primary endpoint event of stroke, systemic embolism, major bleeding, or cardiovascular or unexplained death. Left atrial appendage closure was associated with a higher risk of a composite primary endpoint event over a median follow-up of 3 years. Serious adverse events occurred in 82.5% of patients in the device group and in 77.4% of those in the medical therapy group. Petra Vadimsky from Charles University, Prague, Czech Republic, writes in an editorial that the findings in the trial by Landmesser and co-authors should have immediate and important clinical effect. The message for the clinician is clear. Left atrial appendage closure failed to fulfill its theoretical promise to become an alternative treatment to best medical therapy, at least for older patients such as those enrolled in the trial. Best individualized medical therapy should remain standard treatment for older patients. The left atrial appendage closure device is just one recent example of an interventional device entering the clinical cardiology realm on the basis of borderline evidence. Medicine in the 21st century is evolving more and more technically, sometimes for the benefit of patients, and sometimes despite the absence of clear benefit. Financial incentives, together with a wide interest among healthcare staff to work on the cutting edge of current techniques, may lead to overuse of some interventional procedures. All physicians should be aware of society guidelines, and in the decision-making process for each patient, practitioners should keep in mind the overall clinical benefit of an interventional procedure from a common sense perspective. In general, the benefit from any percutaneous intervention in cardiology is often the greatest with regard to the most acute or life-threatening problem the patient is facing. In contrast, in clinical situations in which the patient's life is not directly at risk and the symptoms are controllable with medical treatment, conservative management should always be considered as an equally effective alternative. CRISPR-Cas12a gene editing of HBG1 and HBG2 promoters to treat sickle cell disease. By Robbie Hanna, from the Cleveland Clinic, Ohio, and co-authors. Renesgamglogene autogedtemcel, or RENICEL, is an investigational CRISPR-Cas12a gene-edited autologous hematopoietic stem cell therapy. The therapy was designed to disrupt the BCL11A binding sites in the HBG1 and HBG2 promoters to reactivate fetal hemoglobin production for the treatment of sickle cell disease. In this phase 1-2 trial, 28 patients with severe sickle cell disease received a single infusion of RENICEL after myeloablative conditioning with busulfan. The median duration of follow-up was 9.5 months. Treatment with RENICEL led to normalization of the total hemoglobin level and an increase in the percentage of fetal hemoglobin, with no vaso-occlusive events occurring in 27 of 28 patients after the infusion. These results support further investigation of this gene editing approach in the treatment of patients with severe sickle cell disease. CRISPR-Cas12a gene editing of HBG1 and HBG2 promoters to treat beta thalassemia by Haydar Frangoul from the Sarah Cannon Research Institute, Nashville, Tennessee, and co-authors. RENICEL, is also under investigation for the treatment of transfusion-dependent beta thalassemia. In this Phase 1-2 trial, 9 participants with transfusion-dependent beta thalassemia received reni-cel and were all included in the analysis. The median duration of post-infusion follow-up was 17.5 months. Treatment with reni-cel resulted in rapid neutrophil engraftment, an increase in fetal hemoglobin expression, and transfusion independence. The data support further investigation of Cas12a gene editing of the promoters of HBG1 and HBG2 in the treatment of transfusion-dependent beta thalassemia. Published online first on April 1 on NEJM.org are the results from a Phase 1-2 study by Ashish Gupta from the University of Minnesota, Minneapolis, and co-authors on base editing of HBG1 and HBG2 promoters as a treatment for sickle cell disease. In the study, 31 patients received ristoglogene autogatemcel, or RistoCell, and were followed for a mean of 6.6 months. Treatment with RistoCell was followed by rapid engraftment and durable expression of fetal hemoglobin and reduction in sickle hemoglobin. In an editorial, Franco Locatelli from the IRCCS Bambino Gesù Children's Hospital, Rome, writes that, overall, the studies by Frangoul et al., Hanna et al., and Gupta et al. corroborate the role of gene editing as a potentially curative treatment for patients with hemoglobinopathies. The trial by Gupta et al., although preliminary, may point to a therapeutic option for patients in the future. Unfortunately, Editas Medicine, the sponsor of the 2 reni-cel trials, decided to discontinue the development of reni-cel owing to a reassessment of clinical development priorities, including a transition to in vivo gene editing. Thus, although the data reported by Frangoul et al. And Hanna et al. Are notable with respect to safety and efficacy, the decision to terminate research on reni-cel eliminates one potential option for patients, sadly turning the promising outcomes of the 2 studies into a kind of Pyrrhic victory. More follow-up is needed to assess the long-term safety profile and confirm the durability of the benefit with these gene editing approaches, though the development of reni-cel has been discontinued. Discontinuation of beta blocker therapy after myocardial infarction by Ki Hong Choi from the Sungkyung Kwan University School of Medicine, Seoul, South Korea, and co-authors. The role of long-term beta blocker therapy after a myocardial infarction in patients without left ventricular systolic dysfunction or heart failure is unclear in the era of contemporary coronary artery reperfusion and secondary prevention interventions. In this trial conducted at 25 centers in South Korea, 2,540 patients whose condition remained stable after a myocardial infarction, who had a left ventricular ejection fraction of at least 40% and no heart failure, and who had received beta blocker therapy for at least 1 year after the myocardial infarction, were randomly assigned to discontinue or to continue beta blocker therapy. Among these patients, discontinuation of beta blocker therapy was non-inferior to continuation with respect to a composite of death from any cause, recurrent myocardial infarction, or hospitalization for heart failure. GLP-1 receptor agonists, a review article by Clifford Rosen from Tufts University School of Medicine, Boston, and Julie Engelfinger, deputy editor for the journal. Glucagon-like peptide 1, GLP-1, receptor agonists are incretin analogs that promote glucose-mediated insulin release and are used to treat type 2 diabetes mellitus and obesity. GLP-1 receptor agonists and GLP-1 and glucose-dependent insulinotropic peptide agonists have several mechanisms of action, including reduction of gastric emptying, inhibition of glucagon secretion, beneficial changes in the intestinal microbiome, and direct effects on hypothalamic nuclei to enhance satiety, which promotes weight loss. Beyond the impressive effects of GLP-1 receptor agonists on blood glucose levels and body weight, large-scale randomized control trials have shown that GLP-1 receptor agonists reduce cardiovascular risk and slow progression to kidney failure in persons at high risk, and including those with type 2 diabetes. Adverse side effects from GLP-1 receptor agonists are mostly gastrointestinal, but may also include loss of muscle and bone mass. Questions remain about long-term adherence, weight regain after discontinuation of treatment, and the functional implications of the loss of muscle and bone mass. Recent and ongoing targeted studies suggest the possibility of additional uses for GLP-1 receptor agonists. Too much of a good thing. A clinical problem solving by Mark Wynen from the Erasmus Medical Center, Rotterdam, the Netherlands, and co-authors. A 57-year-old man was brought to the emergency department after 3 days of vomiting and progressive confusion. In the hospital, he became disoriented, weak, and unable to remember his medications, then developed difficulty speaking and swallowing. Brain imaging and cerebrospinal fluid studies were unrevealing, but his condition worsened to coma, requiring intubation. A markedly elevated plasma ammonia level, 344 micromoles per liter, revealed non-cirrhotic hyperammonemia as the cause of his encephalopathy. He received urgent treatment with protein restriction, intravenous dextrose, nitrogen scavengers, arginine, carnitine, lactulose, and rifamycin, and his ammonia level fell rapidly. He regained consciousness by hospital day 5. Plasma amino acid testing suggested a proximal urea cycle defect. Genetic sequencing identified a pathogenic variant in the OTC gene, confirming ornithine transcarbamylase, OTC, deficiency. OTC deficiency is the most common urea cycle disorder manifesting in adulthood and has an X-linked inheritance pattern. On presentation, the patient had been questioned regarding dietary changes. He reported no such changes and no use of protein supplements. Additional history taking after he regained consciousness revealed that 3 days before admission, he had consumed a large protein-rich meal at an all-you-can-eat restaurant. Management of OTC deficiency includes dietary protein restriction and pharmacotherapy with nitrogen scavengers and citrulline or arginine. The patient was advised not to exceed a protein intake of 1.2 grams per kilogram per day. Physicians, corporatization, and the unmeasured quality of care. A perspective by Lawrence Casolino from Weill Cornell Medicine, New York. There have been increasingly elaborate efforts to measure the quality of healthcare provided by organizations and individual physicians in the United States, and to reward high-quality care. Despite this, key areas of quality aren't measured, and probably couldn't be measured. For example, a clinician's ability to make timely, accurate diagnoses, a skill that is highly respected by clinicians and useful to patients, most likely isn't measurable by scale. For areas of healthcare in which quality isn't measured, society depends on professionalism, including the intrinsic motivation of physicians and other clinicians to provide good care and to put patients' interests above their own, and, when necessary, above those of their organizations. corporate organizations, those that are very large or are owned by entities with strong short-term incentives to maximize profits, may be less likely than other organizations to support physicians' intrinsic motivation, however. And physicians are increasingly employed in organizations owned or controlled by corporations or other large entities. There is evidence that corporatization is leading to higher prices, higher healthcare spending, and unchanged quality, or poorer quality, as in the case of private equity acquisitions of hospitals and nursing homes. Many current policies aren't based on evidence and tend intentionally or frequently inadvertently to reward corporatization. This author suggests policies that policymakers could develop to limit the negative effects of corporatization, including in the unmeasured areas, while allowing the healthcare system to benefit from the capital and managerial expertise it can provide. The age illusion: limitations of chronological age in medicine. A perspective by Martin Lee, from the Hospital Privado Regional del Sur, Bariloche, Argentina. A hypothetical 86-year-old man, Mr. D, was diagnosed with atrial fibrillation. He lived independently, managed his own finances, cooked daily, and went on a walk most mornings. His cognition had been found to be intact during a recent screening examination, and his medical history was otherwise unremarkable. Nonetheless, at the time of diagnosis, Mr. D was considered frail, a judgment based largely on his chronologic age, not on findings from a structured evaluation of his strength, mobility, or physiological reserve, the capacity to tolerate stress beyond that involved in baseline functioning. Because of concerns about falls and Mr. D's presumed vulnerability to bleeding complications, anticoagulation was deferred. 3 months later, Mr. D had a large left middle cerebral artery stroke. A man who had been tending his garden weeks earlier now required institutional care. This hypothetical case reflects a common phenomenon. Patients' chronologic age, information that is typically readily available to clinicians, is often used as a substitute for individualized evaluation of aging-related risk factors. Yet people of the same age can differ dramatically when it comes to cognitive ability, vascular health, metabolism, and physical strength. Clinicians making decisions primarily on the basis of chronologic age may miss important biologic factors that could affect long-term outcomes. Biologic aging involves changes that affect different tissues and different people in various ways. This author argues that an integrated estimate of biologic age could help recalibrate decision-making in settings where chronologic age currently dominates. Therapies conversion: Chiles versus Salazar's threat to mental health treatment and standards of care. A perspective by Michael Ulrich from Boston University School of Public Health. On the second day of the U.S. Supreme Court's current term, the practice of medicine was once again before the nation's highest court. Chiles versus Salazar concerns a First Amendment free speech challenge to Colorado's prohibition of attempts by state-licensed therapists to change the sexual orientation or gender identity of minors, a prohibition also in place in 23 other states. Kaylee Chiles, a state-licensed therapist, has argued that talk therapy is akin to speech used during a book club meeting and therefore cannot be restricted on the basis of standards of care, as other forms of medical practice are. Since this argument raises broader questions of whether talk therapy qualifies as treatment or medical practice at all, the court's ruling could have serious consequences for the health and well-being of LGBTQ+ people, the authority and validity of mental health professionals, and the legal relevance of standards of care. Chile's is not about free speech. It's about whether the state can enforce standards of care. If the court does strike down Colorado's narrow law, and in the process similar laws in 23 other states, so soon after sustaining Tennessee's complete ban, it will further demonstrate that a majority of the justices believe they are the ultimate arbiters of proper medical care. This outcome would have grave consequences for clinicians and patients alike. In our images in clinical medicine, a 12-year-old boy with severe idiopathic acute necrotizing pancreatitis underwent CT that showed a right portal vein thrombus and a wedge-shaped area of hyperperfusion corresponding to the liver region supplied by the thrombosed vein. This finding is consistent with the hepatic arterial buffer response, which is a physiologic mechanism that maintains stable hepatic blood flow. In another image, a 68-year-old woman with rosacea presented with a 6-week history of dark patches on the skin of her arms and legs. 2 weeks before the onset of the skin changes, she had started taking minocycline daily. A diagnosis of minocycline-induced hyperpigmentation, a well-recognized adverse effect of this treatment, was made. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.